not one to be shared with FBI HQS, and certainly not the intelligence community. As I discovered during my first day at the SIOC, the FBI valued oral communications as much as or more than written communication. The reasons varied. The special agents harbored a reluctance to write anything that could be deemed discoverable by any future defense counsel. They maintained investigative flexibility and less risk if their findings were not written, or at least not formally drafted and submitted into a data system. They were not recruited, selected, or trained to write. This special agent culture emphasized investigations and arrests over writing and analysis. There was also an element of rank and status consciousness. Agents did not write because clerks and analysts did. Agents generally viewed writing as a petty chore best left to others. In contrast, while a few CIA operations officers avoided drafting reports, the overwhelming majority had to write copiously and quickly. To have the president or other senior policymakers benefit from clandestine written reports, that was the holy grail. CIA officers prized clear, high-impact written content. The second major difference between the FBI and CIA was their information systems. The FBI did not have one, at least one that functioned. An FBI analyst could not understand a field office's investigation unless the analyst traveled to that office and spent days or weeks working with its agents. With minimal reporting, there was no other choice. With minimal reporting, how could the FBI construct an effective information system? In contrast, CIA stations wrote reports on just about everything, because without written reports, there was no intelligence for analysts and other customers to assess. The CIA required high-speed information systems with massive data management and analysis, and upgraded these systems constantly. The third difference was size. The FBI was enormous compared with the CIA. The FBI personnel deployed to investigate the bombings in East Africa outnumbered all the CIA operations officers on the entire African continent. The FBI's New York field office had more agents than the CIA had operations officers for the entire planet. The FBI dispatched at least two agents for almost any task. The concept of partners in an operational context contrasted sharply with my previous work as a singleton ops officer. CIA officers usually operated alone, certainly in the development, assessment, recruitment, and handling of sources. A fourth difference was the importance of sources and the attitude toward them. While both the FBI and CIA placed a premium on a good source, the FBI did not actively pursue them beyond the context of an investigation. They would follow leads and seek a cooperative witness or a snitch, often compelled to cooperate or face legal consequences. The FBI agents seldom discussed sources even in general terms, but when they did, it was often in derogatory fashion. They did discuss suspects at length. That was their pursuit. And sometimes for the FBI, sources and suspects were one and the same. On the other hand, CIA officers routinely compared notes and lessons learned about spotting, assessing, developing, recruiting, and handling sources, although couched so that specific sources were not revealed. Ops officers' missions and their sense of accomplishment, even their own professional identity, depended on the success of sources and the intelligence they produced. FBI agents wanted evidence and testimony from witnesses that led to convictions and press conferences. A fifth difference was money. The FBI had severe limitations on what their agents could spend and how they could spend it. The process to authorize the payment of an informant or just to travel somewhere was laborious and time-consuming. As a CIA officer, I routinely carried several thousand dollars in cash as an operational necessity to entertain prospective recruitment targets, compensate sources, buy equipment, rent a truck, charter an aircraft, and bribe foreign officials to get things done. I would usually need to replenish my well-used revolving fund every month. When I told FBI agents this, they seemed doubtful that such behavior could be allowed or was even legal. I often had to explain that the CIA did not break U.S. laws, just foreign laws. Sixth, the FBI harbored a sense that because they worked under the Department of Justice, they had more legal authority than the CIA. Some, after a few drinks, also expressed moral objections to the CIA's covert action or dirty tricks, perhaps a reflection of U.S. society's view. I would argue that covert action, directed by the president and approved by congressional oversight committees, is legal. But somehow the notion of breaking foreign laws seemed less than ideal to some of my FBI partners. In one hot exchange, I rhetorically asked if my oath to defend the Constitution held any less value than the oath of an FBI special agent. Seventh, the FBI loved the press and worked hard to curry favor with it. For the CIA's clandestine service, the media was taboo. Some CIA officers hated the press. Most of us had experienced occasions when media leaks undermined operations. Sometimes our sources died because of press play. On top of that, the media seemed intent on portraying the CIA in a negative light. A CIA operations officer avoided the press like the plague. For the FBI, it was very different. Positive press could help fight crime and boost prestige and resources. Every FBI field office worked the media. Eighth, the FBI collected evidence for its own use, to prosecute a criminal. The CIA primarily collected intelligence for others, whether a policymaker, warfighter, diplomat, or law enforcement officer. The FBI, therefore, lacked a culture of customer service beyond the Department of Justice. Without a customer for intelligence, the CIA had no mission. Ninth, the FBI's field offices, especially New York, acted as their own centers of authority, including holding evidence and potential intelligence, because of the link to the local prosecutor. A local district attorney and other political actors in the city had great influence over an investigation. The CIA station had to report intelligence to CIA HQS because the incentive came from there and beyond, particularly the White House. Tenth, the FBI worked Congress. Every FBI field office had representatives dedicated to supporting congressional delegates. The FBI had the authority to investigate members of Congress for illegal activity. The FBI had both carrots and sticks when dealing with Congress. On the other hand, the CIA, particularly the clandestine service, had minimal leverage with Congress. Most CIA officers engaged Congress only when required to testify. No wonder, I surmised, that the FBI was so strong politically and the CIA so weak. These conclusions, roughed out by the end of 1998, were reinforced when I started traveling to FBI field offices. To learn about their investigations into terrorism cases, I had to go into the field. With minimal reporting requirements and no functioning information system, there was no other way. The FBI investigations were retrospective, tied to past or ongoing criminal activities in the United States. Even with that narrow investigative focus, however, there was no shortage of work. Hamas raised money through charities, money used to support their terrorist attacks against Israeli targets. Hezbollah did the same. In a Detroit suburb, I walked into local stores with large glass containers adorned with Hezbollah symbols and photos. The big jars were stuffed with cash donations. Hezbollah also ran rackets throughout the United States, from selling counterfeit baby formula to smuggling cigarettes. There was scant collection against AQ, except for the evidence being compiled by the New York office in support of their criminal investigation. Most FBI agents I encountered in the domestic field knew very little about international terrorism or the global geopolitical context. New York was different, in part because of the U.S. Southern District's responsibility for the prosecution of AQ. Another reason was Special Agent in Charge, SAC, John O'Neill. A brilliant zero-sum egomaniac and a lover of the high life, John understood the AQ threat and pursued the enemy with a raw passion. I despised John's bureaucratic gamesmanship. I loved his brute force when aimed at the enemy. That was the critical element, keeping John pointed at the enemy and not everybody else in the U.S. government. We screamed at each other at least every couple of weeks, usually on the same theme. It would have been comical, except the anger was real, although fleeting. A typical conversation. "You CIA fucks are holding back evidence. I should arrest you for obstruction of justice," John hollered into the phone. "I work for the FBI, not the CIA, but you want to arrest me? Come down.